We're going to continue now with the prepared portion. By way of giving some background to a number of things that we're going to be talking about in weeks to come, we're going to be talking about Germany. We're going to be talking about the remaking of the Bundeswehr, the German army, into an offensive force. We're going to be talking about Germany's foreign policy, its national security policy, the reemergence of the Nazi elements that were never effectively purged from Germany, and a number of very, very disturbing things on the European political horizon. The primary factor underlying the failure of denazification in Europe at the end of World War II, Germany in particular, the root explanation for that failure really lies here in the United States. I've dealt at great length with the terrifying and ongoing reality of fascism in the United States. Fascism is not something alien to this country. Many of our most prominent industrialists and financiers were ardently pro-fascist. Some of them would have been in the defendant's dock at Nuremberg had President Roosevelt lived. That's something, by the way, that's discussed in the new book, The Secret War Against the Jews, by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. We've also dealt with the 1934 coup attempt. In fact, in Radio Free America program number 10, I deal with the 1934 coup attempt by way of analyzing the evolution of American fascism over the decades. That was a coup attempt in the United States organized by industrialists and financiers, primarily some grouped around the House of Morgan. They were embittered by Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, considered him a traitor to his social class, and undertook to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt and replace him with a Mussolini-style dictatorship. The general that was tabbed to lead that coup attempt, fortunately, although a conservative and quite critical of Roosevelt in many respects, was a genuine patriot and a genuine Democrat with a small d, and so he betrayed the coup plotters' plans to Franklin Roosevelt. There was a tragically attenuated congressional investigation, the McCormick-Dickstein Committee, which looked into the fascist coup attempt. I replay that segment of Radio Free America number 10 every Memorial Day as part of the Uncle Sam and the Swastika Memorial Day special. And the discussion of the 34 coup attempt is to be found within two archive shows. One, Radio Free America number 10, and also the Family Values program that I did after the 1994 off-year elections. By way of gaining some historical perspective about the degree to which fascism was something that had become accepted by what, for lack of a better term, one could call the American power structure, we're going to take a look at a couple of items, and we are going to draw once again on the magnificent research of George Seldes, viewed by many as the Dean of American Investigative Reporters, an individual whose landmark work on fascism is something that we have dealt with at great length in the past. Specifically, we're going to be taking a look at a couple of excerpts from one of Seldes' books entitled Even the Gods Can't Change History, subtitled The Facts Speak for Themselves. It's by George Seldes, last name S-E-L-D-E-S, published by Lyle Stewart and Company out of New Jersey, and this is copyright 1976. Appendix A of Even the Gods Can't Change History, there is a remarkable anecdote concerning an impending court-martial of the aforementioned Major General Smedley Butler, two-time winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor and a Commandant of the Marine Corps, for having slandered Mussolini in a discussion with President Herbert Hoover. Once again, what we're talking about here is a Major General in the United States Marine Corps facing a court-martial. It was aborted for reasons we'll discuss in a minute. A court-martial for insulting Benito Mussolini, the fascist dictator of Italy. As we've seen in the past, drawing again on the research of George Seldes, Mussolini was named a member of the American Legion, an honorary member of the American Legion in 1935, that nomination later rescinded on a technicality. We're going to discuss Smedley Butler's almost getting court-martialed for having slandered Mussolini to then-President Herbert Hoover, right now. In Appendix 4, rather, not Appendix A, Appendix 4 of Even the Gods Can't Change History, we find the following. By the way, most of the information in this book is reprinted from George Seldes' remarkable In Fact series. That was a magazine that he had in the 1930s and 40s. Appendix 4 reads, in 1931, Major General Smedley D. Butler, Commandant of the U.S. Marines, faced court-martial because of an alleged insult to Mussolini. Inasmuch as the present editor of this weekly was in 1931 engaged in writing Sawdust Caesar, he placed at General Butler's disposal the true facts concerning Mussolini. As a result of this association with the Commandant of the Marines, here is a news story which has not yet been told. President Hoover wanted to court-martial General Butler to please fascist Italy. In 1931, in a speech in Philadelphia, Butler had repeated a story previously told by Cornelius Vanderbilt, that while Mussolini and he were driving through an Italian town, the Duce was a confessed speed lawbreaker. He ran over a child and then made the following remark. Never look backward, Vanderbilt. Unquote. What is one life in the affairs of state? Again, unquote. Butler called Mussolini a wild, mad dog. Unquote. Hoover ordered Secretary of the Navy Charles Adams to prefer charges. If found guilty, General Butler could have been dismissed or given 15 years imprisonment. When In Fact's editor gave General Butler the documented history of Mussolini's political murders, including the Filippelli confession of Mussolini's part in the assassination of Matteotti, General Butler said he did not think President Hoover would ever let the case come to trial. Interrupting, we've dealt with the assassination of Member of Parliament Matteotti, a socialist deputy in the Italian Parliament, who exposed the connections between Mussolini and many of the top industrialists and financiers of Italy, at whose will, Mussolini did what he did. Basically, as George Seldes, whose work we drew upon in the archive show, of Uncle Sam and Il Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State. We drew on not only the book Sawdust Caesar, alluded to here, but also Can These Things Be? From 1931. And the assassination of Matteotti was discussed in that miscellaneous archive show available from Archives on Audio. Continuing with this segment of Even the Gods Can't Change History, Hoover sent his aide to see me, said Butler. I said, put me on the stand and you'll hear the story of the Boxer Rebellion, unquote. That was all. General Butler was released almost immediately. And George Seldes goes on to describe a very shameful episode during the Boxer Rebellion in which Herbert Hoover, then an engineer, was basically found cowering in a corner when General Butler stationed Tianjin, with the United States Marines, discovered him. I'm not going to go into the particulars concerning Herbert Hoover's cowardice during the Boxer Rebellion. However, I think it's worth noting here that General Butler, again, not only the Commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps, but also a two-time winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor, was going to be court-martialed for slandering Mussolini, the fascist dictator of Italy. This by way of gauging the fascist sentiments within some segments of the American military. Again, I'm not stating that this is true of all or even most American military personnel. I don't want to be misunderstood on that score. Indeed, I think it is pretty obvious that if there were more military people of this sentiment, we would not be as relatively well off as we are these days. One of the many remarkable and very disturbing chapters in Even the Gods Can't Change History concerns the activities of some reactionary American congressmen and also the House Un-American Activities Committee, a body with which William Mandel, a regular guest on this program, clashed some time back. The attempts, successful for a period of time, by elements of the House Un-American Activities Committee and reactionary American congressmen to suppress General Marshall's Army Fact Sheet number 64, Fascism. This concerned an information document that was to be distributed to American troops informing them about fascism, what it comes from, how it operates, and included in that was how to recognize domestic American fascists. It's worth noting that this document was actively suppressed by reactionary elements in the United States, and we are examining it now by way of hoping to understand some of American history. We should note again that many of our most prominent industrialists and financiers were ardently pro-fascist. There were connections, profound connections, pivotal connections between American corporate interests and those in fascist Italy and Nazi Germany before and during the war. And those business relationships, as we looked at in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, continued after the war as well. Again, in the recent book, The Secret War Against the Jews, John Loftus and Mark Aarons reveal, drawing on intelligence sources, that had President Roosevelt lived, he was going to institute a banker's trial for some of the world's financiers who had helped to finance Hitler and Mussolini. Prominent in those prominent in the defendant's box at the banker's trial would have been many American industrialists and financiers. Of course, Roosevelt did not live, so that trial never happened. As in future weeks, we proceed with an examination not only of the reemergence of German fascism, but of the terrifying nationalism that Germany is manifesting now, and of the synthesis between foreign policy, economic policy, and military policy in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. It's worth understanding that the seeds of much of what is taking place right now were sown at the end of World War II, and the failure to denazify Germany, the failure to denazify the German army, the responsibility for that, really, lies largely with the United States. And indeed, as we shall see, attempting to inform the American army about fascism, while indeed the American army was engaged in a war against fascism, was no mean feat. And the fascist elements in the United States, very, very powerful elements they were very successful for quite some time in getting General George Marshall's fact sheet number 64 suppressed. Seldes writes about this in Even the Gods Can't Change History. Rankin, with the help of his chief counsel, Ernie Adamson, that's a reactionary congressman, Rankin, R-A-N-K-I-N, with the help of his chief counsel, Ernie Adamson, collaborated with the Hearst Washington Bureau and destroyed the Marshall Enlightenment Plan. And it was a noted Hearst member of that same bureau who sent the story to, in fact. By the way, interrupting in Radio Free America program number one, looking back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War, Part 1, we dealt with the very favorable press given to fascism in, among other publishing empires, the Hearst publishing empire. There were front-page editorials by people like Rudolf Hess, Mussolini, Goering, Alfred Rosenberg, assuring people that fascism was not only a good thing, but that the fascist leaders of Europe wanted nothing but peace. Continuing. Rankin first heard of the Marshall Program when Representative Adolf Sabbath of Illinois, one of InFact's original subscribers, placed the entire contents of one of its issues in the Congressional Record. It was a reprint of Marshall's Fact Sheet number 64, Fascism. This is what Marshall was trying to tell our Army. 1. After explaining Japanese, German, and Italian fascism with its terrorism and mass murders, the pamphlet suggests that not all fascists speak in the language of their countries. Some speak ours. 2. Could fascism rise in the United States after it is crushed abroad, and what can we do to prevent it? Unquote. 3. Fascism is contrasted with democracy. It is then stated that at various times in the United States we have had lynchings, vigilantism, and suppression of civil liberties, and certain fascist elements such as the Black Legion and Pelley's Silver Shirts are actually named. Also mentioned are, quote, religious bigots, unquote, not named. This part concludes, quote, all of them in the name of Americanism, unquote. 4. Any fascist attempt to capture the United States, quote, would work under the guise of super patriotism and super-Americanism, unquote. Again, these bullet points are central points in George Marshall's fact sheet number 64. By the way, that to be distributed to the United States Army. Continuing, 5. Soldiers are advised that it is proper to call members of the Communist Party communists, or Reds for short, but pinning these labels on people whose politics one opposes, quote, is a favorite trick of native as well as foreign fascists, unquote. The fact sheet gives several ways, quote, to identify native fascists and devotes the conclusion to ways to stop fascism in the United States, quote, by making democracy work, unquote. Before inserting the in-fact issue in the Congressional Record, Representative Sabbath addressed the House in concluding with these remarks.
Mr. Speaker, I only regret that the rules and regulations of the War Department preclude the naming of outstanding American fascists such as the DuPonts, the Pews, the Girdlers, the Weirs, General Van Horn Moseley, H.W. Prentice, President of the National Association of Manufacturers, Merwin K. Hart, head of the National Economic Society, and others, including the 30 fascists charged with conspiracy and seditious activities and tried, but due to the untimely death of the trial judge, still at large. Congressman Sabbath's speech created a sort of sensation in the liberal press. The Christian Science Monitor, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and the usual handful of excellent newspapers published parts of fact sheet number 64 and the Sabbath remarks naming a group he considered native fascists. The official organ of the CIO, the News, republished the orientation document, as did the organ of the Railroad Brotherhood's Labor, so that the government statement reached millions outside the Army. Rankin of Mississippi and Claire Hoffman of Michigan then demanded that the Army drop its entire orientation program or tone down its definition of fascism. And the Army surrendered. I did not know this until Henry Hoke published his book, It's a Secret, in which he discloses that H. Ralph Burton, counsel for the House Military Affairs Committee, gave in to the requests of Rankin and Hoffman. Hoke describes Burton as, quote, a thorough reactionary, unquote. Burton was not only a former attorney for William Lüdecke, who had openly proclaimed himself, quote, the number two Nazi in America, unquote, but he was also general counsel for Coughlin's National Union for Social Justice. By the way, that, of course, is Father Coughlin, the radio priest, in some ways the precursor to people like Pat Robertson and also people like Rush Limbaugh. By the way, bear in mind we'll talk about that next week. Bear in mind, Messrs. Limbaugh, etc., we're going to talk a little bit about Father Coughlin in weeks to come. Well, actually, I'll see if we have time to get to it. But Father Coughlin was at one time a paid Nazi agent. This revealed in fact. Back to attempts by reactionary members of Congress and also the House Un-American Activities Committee to suppress fact sheet number 4 about fascism. Fact sheet number 64, excuse me, about fascism. Returning to Even the Gods Can't Change History. Rankin and Chief UAC Counsel Adamson used the Hearst Press to create public opinion in favor of destroying the orientation program. The Hearst Washington correspondent, who had previously been sending in fact, suppressed news, now sent a long report, which I did not publish at the time because he had warned me it might get him into trouble. It began, Washington. Ernie Adamson, counsel for the House Un-American Activities Committee, declared today that an inquiry had disclosed that the U.S. orientation series of Army talks was designed to foster communism. He singled out especially Army Talk No. 64, an expose of fascism, which he termed, quote, probably the high water mark of attempts to communize the armed personnel, unquote. Bear in mind fact sheet, the point number 5 in that fact sheet. Soldiers are advised that it is proper to call members of the Communist Party communists, or Reds for short, but pinning these label on people whose politics one opposes, quote, is a favorite trick of native as well as foreign fascists, unquote. That trick, of course, being used here by Ernie Adamson. Continuing. Adamson said the investigation by his staff of investigators had not yet been completed, but had gone far enough to disclose that the Army talks represented, quote, an attempt to indoctrinate men in the ranks with communistic ideas and philosophy. Adamson said the committee had been informed by Army authorities that the Army talks were no longer being distributed. Quote, some of the gentlemen who participated in drawing them up are out, and we've been assured the skids have been put under them, unquote, he said. Adamson complained, however, that private organizations were now publishing them. Adamson identified Army fact sheet number 64 as, quote, telling the boys how to identify fascists, unquote. The United States, and then Seldes goes on to comment, the United States Army's effort to educate its people about fascism was apparently subversive in the opinion of Congressman Rankin and Attorney Adamson. In the HUAC 1946 report, 79th Congress, House of Representatives, Union Calendar number 66, the Rankin Committee said that General Marshall's authorized document was, quote, one of the dirtiest blots on the history of the War Department, unquote, and characterized it as, again quoting, red poison, unquote, using the phrases previously appearing in the Hearst Press, which had originated this attack on the Army. The destruction of the Army orientation program was not the only reactionary victory in wartime reported during the in-fact decade. Another notable case involved the Office of War Information, or OWI, which President Roosevelt had set up under one of the best-known and most liberal journalists of the time, Elmer Davis. Its purpose was to inform the American public as well as the men in uniform. FDR realized at the time of Pearl Harbor that that infamous action would unite the citizenry, at least for the moment, to support a war against international fascism. However, he also knew that there were still pro-Nazis and pro-fascists in number, and perhaps worst of all, millions who did not know what the real enemy was and did not care. The vast strata of the indifferent and the apathetic. On May 3, 1945, after 16 months of war, in fact charged that despite great publishing activity, the OWI had not issued one little unkind word about the enemy, Nazi fascism. This statement was supported by letters exchanged with the OWI itself. A reader, the Reverend Don L. West of Georgia, had asked for a pamphlet or other material on the nature of the enemy, anything at all except the story of the treacherous attack on Pearl Harbor. In seconding the request, in fact requested a duplicate set for itself. A large package soon arrived, but it contained not one sheet of paper even critical of the fascist forms of government in the nations we were fighting. In fact, then offered OWI the rights to republish whatever chapters it wanted of Sawdust Caesar and exposés of fascism and Nazism in its previous 133 issues. In reply, OWI sent a 2.5-line note saying, quote, "We have a number of projects underway on this subject, and so we shall not have to call on you," unquote. At exactly this time, a schism occurred at OWI. 15 writers, including Henry F. Pringle and Milton Mackay, or McKay, M-A-C-K-A-Y, resigned after issuing a public statement saying, quote, "We are leaving because of our conviction that it is impossible for us, under those who now control our output, to tell the truth," end quote. Truth about what? The only subjects untouched were Nazism and fascism. The three most powerful newspaper chains, Hearst, Scripps Howard, and McCormick Patterson, took this occasion to join in a violent attack on the ONI, demanding its abolition. Little as it had done to enlighten the public and the army, the press of the right was already its enemy. Of course, there were the usual exceptions. The liberal New York Post, for example, knowing what the real trouble at OWI was, headlined its report, "OWI to Soft Pedal War on Fascism." And the very liberal PM used the headline, "Guild Book De-emphasizes Fascism." The latter story, from Gordon Cole, referred to a new book of instructions for writers. Said Cole, quote, "It will teach the writers that the enemy is many bad things, but it will de-emphasize the fact that the enemy is basically fascist. In the 7 sets of instructions or information sheets describing the enemy, the word fascist is mentioned just once." As a result, some officials outside OWI are asking whether this war is now to be sold to the American people as something other than a war against fascism. One of the OWI information sheets is devoted to atrocities and fails to mention that the Nazis committed the most horrible atrocities in modern history. There is not even a mention that the first action of a fascist, also a communist dictatorship, is to abolish the free press and free labor unions. In self-defense, the OWI declared that the 15 writers had resigned because they wanted to publish more pamphlets, thus wasting paper. Max Lerner of the New York Post replied that, quote, "The entire 12-month program of OWI pamphlets did not use up as much paper as a single issue of Life," unquote. The OWI then kept its silence. From Washington, our correspondent gave the reason for the failure of all educational objectives during the war. Fear of the Un-American Committee and their strongest supporters in the House of Representatives, mostly Southerners, several with records of membership in the Ku Klux Klan, the Silver Shirts, and other organizations. These congressmen attacked even Elmer Davis, accusing him of being a member of the American Labor Party, which in their view was un-American or subversive. Quote, the most important fact to remember, wrote our Washington correspondent, again quoting, is that while the United States is fighting the Nazi fascist nations, the Dees Committee and the reactionaries in Congress and also a major part of the American press are still fighting the New Deal. And for many of them, the New Deal is still a greater danger, unquote. The younger reader may find it hard to believe that during the reign of the un-American committees, throughout the war and into the McCarthy era, there was so powerful a pro-fascist element in the House of Representatives. On March 17, 1947, InFact reported that after the United States government had published a book entitled Communism in Action and distributed 100,000 copies free, the Library of Congress Legislative Reference Service, compiler of that work, prepared a 325-page manuscript called Fascism in Action. Two Republican spokesmen, Carl LeConte of Iowa and Robert Corbett of Pennsylvania, kept a House resolution authorizing its publication bottled up in committee. Representative Wright Patman wrote to InFact that he would force publication, quote, even if it means reading it into the congressional record page by page, unquote. The book was the usual, well-researched, impartial job the Library of Congress does for everyone in government, regardless of party. In a brief foreword, Patman states that, quote, there are many symptoms of fascism in our own democratic society, unquote, the only line expressing an editorial viewpoint. On several occasions, for 4 months, Patman insisted that the House authorize publication. On each occasion, Republicans objected. One of them, Ivor Fenton, is on the record saying, quote, what's fascism and what's wrong with it, unquote. Throughout 1947, InFact urged readers to write their congressmen. At one time, the House voted to print a 1,500 copies for use of members, compared to the first printing of 100,000 copies of Communism in Action. Representative Fred Busby of Illinois made a speech in the House attacking InFact and its editor because he said he had investigated 1,000 requests for the proposed book and found that almost all of them came from InFact readers. John Rankin and a Mississippi colleague, John Williams, followed with speeches opposing the publication of any copies. In August, readers reported that when they requested the book on fascism, their representatives, all of them Republicans, sent them instead copies of Communism in Action, in many cases accompanying that book with a note recommending it. In September, a small printing of Fascism in Action was made, but the House refused to permit free distribution. Those who requested it were told to send 40 cents to the superintendent of documents for a pamphlet of 206 pages. At this time, every member of Congress had on hand stacks of copies of Communism in Action, but no copies of the new pamphlet. The number of copies the House allowed for sale to the American public was exactly 600. Patman, seconded by Congresswoman Helen Gahagan Douglas and several others, continued to fight for more printings and for free copies. 2 years after the effort began, Patman was able to announce that the superintendent of documents had sold 36,790 copies of Fascism in Action at 40 cents. He added, quote, the tyranny of the right can be as dangerous as the tyranny of the left, unquote, and again introduced a resolution to allow free distribution of 100,000 of the fascism booklet. By this time, congressmen had already sent out free 600,000 copies of the booklet on communism. Quote, fascism is today an ever-present danger to our democracy, unquote, concluded Patman. No newspaper reported either his fight for the pamphlet or his speeches. It was either suppression or indifference.
That was how I concluded my program, or the last segment of my program, on a Sunday, July 2nd of 1995. I awoke the next day to see George Seldes' obituary. George Seldes, as it turns out, had passed away on July 2nd of 1995, and I'm going to read a section of the obituary that appeared in the New York Times on Monday, July 3rd of 1995. The obituary is written by William Dick, or Dickie, D-I-C-K-E. It's headlined, George Seldes is Dead at 104, an early, fervent press critic. It reads in part as follows, skipping down of the newsletter In Fact, upon or from which that last segment that I read to you was drawn. In Fact, which claimed 176,000 subscribers at its peak in 1947, had a self-described progressive view and was established to present, quote, the real inside news, the kind newspapers frequently get but dare not print, unquote, Mr. Seldes wrote when he helped found it. Again quoting, George Seldes was an important force for good in American journalism, said Ben H. Bagdikian, the press critic, in an interview. Again quoting, in the years just before and after World War II, when standard publishing practice was far more wedded than it is today to archaic conventions of slighting non-establishment news, Seldes was a lonely and critical source of important information and insights, unquote. In fact, which has been described as the nation's first successful journalism review, also carried strong attacks on business and issued warnings against what Mr. Seldes regarded as reactionary forces. A favorite target was the National Association of Manufacturers. Skipping down, for 3 years, Mr. Seldes covered the Spanish Civil War as a freelancer, concluding, he said later, that news coverage of the conflict was marred by unthinking acceptance of lies from the pro-Franco side. After returning to the United States, he wrote the two books on the American press which his reputation as a newspaper critic largely rests. In Lords of the Press, published in 1935, he offered mostly scathing portraits of the nation's major newspapers. In Freedom of the Press in 1938, he discussed the influence of business interests on the press and declared that more censorship was caused by advertising pressures than by government. He called for an ethics code for reporters and lived long enough to see journalism schools offer ethics courses and press organizations give attention to ethical issues. Quote, even for later journalists who did not accept all of Seldes' analysis, he had an effect on forcing a great number of people to consider what the role of journalism really is, unquote Mr. Bagdikian said. After Seldes' newsletter ceased publication in 1950, when his warnings about fascism seemed out of tune with rising public concern about communism, he found new outlets for his writing. And again, the segments of Even the Gods Can't Change History were drawn from information originally published in Fact. George Seldes dead at 104 on Monday, July 2nd, the date that was recorded. Well done, George. Rest in peace.